Start this.
Boom. We're back with another episode of the CBA's ABCs of Bow Hunting. I'm Jake Kunkin, solo this time around, but I'm here with... Actually, Ryan, I don't know how to pronounce your last name.
It's a tough one, but it's Vonderak.
Vonderak. All right. Well, Vondi on Instagram, which is easy. Is that like a nickname or is that just...
Yeah, that's a nickname that all my friends call me, so...
Beautiful. Well, I was actually out at the archery range getting ready for whitetail season a couple weeks ago and saw Ryan out on the range and we just started chatting. He has a similar truck, maybe a little nicer. We won't talk about that. And then just started talking about the season and hunting and then found out you were in the CBA and I was like, man, your stories are interesting. Your photography's really good. This fucking 14-inch antelope you brought here is pretty damn cool. That's from this year, right?
It is.
So I was like, you know what? I just want to talk to this guy. I'm always interested in these guys who started the CBA, how they did it, like pioneering the rules of bow hunting and carving out a space for us. But I'm also interested in the guys that are like around my age, but like kind of a few steps ahead of me. And I'm like, huh, that's the guy I should be watching. Cause the old guy who's not give up all his secrets, but maybe just tell us some awesome stories. I kind of want to be like you when I grow up, even though we're probably the same age. I saw that you are like an athlete, a triathlete, a fisherman, you hunt birds, right? So you're kind of an all-around sportsman, which is really cool. And I was curious if you could give the audience like a little background about yourself, your history. Are you from Colorado? How'd you get into athletics, triathletes? How'd you get into hunting?
Yeah, so I'm originally from Northern California. Growing up there, I was always outside, you know, all hours of the day.
Yeah, yeah.
Mom and dad always had to make sure that I had to come in for dinner. But, yeah, you know, I was really big into fishing. Even when I originally lived in California, my dad would always take me out there and we'd do some, you know, local bass and stuff like that. And, you know, kept that interest all the way through high school and ended up going to University of Colorado at Boulder.
Oh, really?
And, yeah.
That's awesome.
And so while I was there... I worked for Front Range Anglers there in Boulder.
Shop that's right there.
Yeah,
right?
So yeah, I worked there and, you know, was really big into the fly fishing thing. And one thing led to another. Met some family that lives out here, John, who kind of got me into the big game hunting.
You met some of your own family, like relatives.
Yep.
Cool, cool.
So when I found out that I was coming to Colorado, made a couple phone calls. We have a pretty big family. And turns out cousin John was a CSU Ram. And, he wanted to show me the ropes and got a little bit of a rivalry going there. So,
hell yeah.
Yeah, but he ended up getting me into big game hunting and definitely thankful for that.
That's awesome. And it is interesting how it's all sort of like a gateway drug. Like you get into fishing and then you kind of finding new spots, new species, maybe tying your own flies or whatever you do. And you're like, huh, there's so many other pursuits you could go down such a deep rabbit hole, whether it's small game hunting, archery, for me, spearfishing, and like just kind of realizing that's kind of what brought me into this world. So I've been spearfishing for about 8 years now, and the nuances and the similarities between bow hunting and spearfishing are like very, very high. And so I could totally see that. Like someone opens somebody like your eyes to that and just take off.
Yeah,
so did it start with like rifle or did it start with archery or how did he introduce you to hunting?
Yeah, so funny story. My first ever big game hunt was for elk.
Uh-huh.
It was a second rifle hunt here in Colorado. And I think this was probably in 2016.
Cool.
We went out and saw some bulls at first light.
Whoa.
Closed the distance, 150 yards, one shot. I was done in 30 minutes.
No way, man. It's so interesting to see because it's not necessarily beginner's luck. Like there's luck in terms of like you don't always know where the animals are going to be. But just that idea of like some people will struggle for years to get their first animal and stick with it. And some people get their first animal and give up because they're like, all right, I get what it's about. I had a buddy where he was interested in us going spearfishing, and I had been going for 3 or 4 years. My buddies had been going like 4 or 5 years. This is his first day, and in 5 feet of water, he shot the biggest bass any of us have ever shot in our whole life, and he's never gone spearfishing again. And we're like, you asshole. Like, you think it's the easiest thing in the world, and we don't know what we're doing.
Yeah, I can definitely tell you that it has not been like that ever since. Mm-hmm. So
no more.
You know, now you have to put 30 minute kills. Oh, gosh. The last 2 seasons for archery, I've put in probably close to, you know, 15 to 20 days each season.
Damn, that's awesome.
And yeah, I'm sure we'll get to that, but
yeah,
come up just a little bit short each of these last 2 years, unfortunately.
On the archery elk?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've been doing archery elk for 2 years, and last year I put in one stalk and saw like one animal, and this year I was at full draw a couple of times. I called a bull in to like 40 yards, and it was just like, okay, completely different year. Still don't have an elk to show for it, but you could just kind of feel like, all right, I'm inching a little bit closer, I'm inching a little bit closer. That being said, the realization that the guys who are like nice with it, there's only one opening day per state. So like time and money and resources is one thing, but just that idea of like experience, boots on the ground experience, there's nothing besides like age. I mean, if you can hunt two or three times, two or three elk seasons, like in Utah, August 15th or whatever, August 28th, and then kind of get yourself a few opening days, like accelerate that learning curve even more. But for 9 to 5 people, like, man, it's crazy to see people who are really good at this stuff.
Yeah, I look back now and I definitely cringe at some of the stuff that I did my first archery season, you know, using the Hoochie Mama and the flexible bugle tube. I cannot even imagine what I sounded like.
But yeah.
Fortunately enough, a bull came, you know, right in, and I was able to close the deal my first year of archery. So
hell yeah. I realized that it's both a benefit and a detriment to like not having a ton of family to introduce me to hunting, because the detriment is like, you gotta spend the money, bite the bullet, like do the actual legwork. But the other side of it is, the only people I'm listening to are like Corey Jacobson or John Dudley, like people who are putting good, useful information out there. There's a ton now that I know a little bit about elk hunting. You can hear how many people are kind of faking it out there and selling some stuff. Oh, November 3rd, do this. Where? What are you talking about? Do this. So yeah. It's funny to get enough experience to start to see some of the bullshitters, but I feel like my ethics are pretty strong because I don't have some uncle who's like, oh, just do it this way, yeah. You know? But then again, like, I don't have that hunting history. I have the hunting heritage. Like, obviously, we got here through hunting, but it may be 2 or 3 generations removed.
Yeah, I'm kind of in the same boat as you two. Like, all of my mentorship has been through rifle hunting, pretty much. Mm-hmm. I've never had anyone take me out and show me, like, this is what you do.
Yeah.
You know, this is how it works type of thing. And the learning curve for archery is, you know, definitely more than rifle. Getting close to those things and being quiet and using the wind and all that stuff, I mean, just can't be overstated enough. It's tough to get close to those animals.
Mm-hmm. I'm starting to kind of equate both rifle and archery hunting, but more archery hunting, with like, it's like a balancing act of like 20 different objects. And it's not like the next year you get that much better at balancing it. You might know what you need to balance, but you still need to like have your shot dialed, have your weapon dialed, your broadhead tuned, know where you're going, get your timing right, make sure you wake up to that first alarm, don't hit snooze. Like, it's all of these things that you have to keep doing every year. And I think it makes me even more impressive that the guys keep showing up, because it's like, huh, every year I need to work a little harder than the year I did before. So if you times that by 10 years or 15 or 20, it's like those guys fucking work their asses off.
Yeah, they do.
You might find a spot and get a honey hole, but you still work your ass off. And I'm like, huh.
Okay. There'll always be those lucky people. But I mean, geez, it is a ton of work just to get out there. And all the stuff you're talking about, waking up early, driving out there, all of the resources it takes just to get you in position to where you can start hunting is,
yeah,
that's half the battle.
For archery, I probably had like 9 or 11 days in this season in Colorado, but I also probably had 15 to 20 days of scouting and just traveling, because I kind of like, once the ski season, snowboard season dries up, I'm like, all right, my focus is hunting, whether that's like conditioning or hiking or scouting, but like it's all just kind of generically centric around the hunting pursuit. So I do realize like how much time you have to put in on both ends of like before season opens, after season opens, and then like the day after season closes, and remember to like put in all the work that you wish you did the year before. So you jumped into rifle to elk, and then was that the only big game hunt you had that year?
That was 2016. Yep, that was my only hunt that year, and I was still in college then, so I was kind of, after that, I was lucky enough to come back and help my brother and dad get their first bulls as well. But I was going, you know, to and from class.
Oh, wow.
Driving. Yeah. So
that's awesome. But it's also so exciting to like be a part of it. One, you got it done with your cousin, but I went on a rifle hunt this year with some buddies, and my buddy killed an elk. And just to be in the group of people who's like doing it the right way, it's like, all right, I moved out here for a reason. I'm involved with that purpose. So to be able to help your brother, help your dad is really cool.
Yeah, I've been on a number of hunts now that weren't mine.
Yeah.
And I'm still just as excited, you know, when someone puts something down as when I do it myself.
Yeah.
And I just love being a part of that and helping with the pack out, the scouting, and
hell yeah,
just seeing how happy other people are too. I've gotten, you know, a number of other people involved, and just seeing their growth has been really cool as well.
It's so cool to be like stoked for somebody else. I mean, the guy I went rifle hunting with, I just met him, like, you met him on the archery range. We talked for like the last like 2 years. We'll snowboard together occasionally. We'll shoot together occasionally. And then he was like, hey man, I'm going, you look like you hunt hard. Like, let's go do it. And he was perfectly happy to have me. And so it is cool to like see those relationships and be, I'm just as stoked for him to get a bull. He gave me some meat, but yeah, just as stoked for see it on his wall as I am on mine. Like you said it before we started recording, but like, as long as you keep doing this, as like, as you keep yourself in the mix, like it's going to happen. Things are going to happen. You're not going to like get significantly worse every year, you know, God forbid some sort of ailment, but like just that idea of like patience, persistence, it's going to get done.
Yeah. I mean, these antelope that I've killed the last 2 years on this over-the-counter archery tag are a true testament to that. I've killed both of them on the very last day of the season when I've probably put in 15 to 20 days before that. You know, last day, last hour, but all it takes is that one, and you just got to go. I remember walking back this year after a failed stalk, and it was like 5 o'clock, and I was just like, man, I kind of want to go home, but there's a buck over there. I got to go see if I can make it happen.
Yeah.
And sure enough.
Well, that's the thing too. And it's a trick in your mind between like, I was talking to a buddy I met out in the unit I was hunting this year, and you have that thing in your brain of like, okay, maybe I'm seeing less animals, maybe I'm a little more tired, maybe the pressure's on or they've moved off. And you can always have a reason to like not do it. And that balance between like, I'm a giant loser for not showing up, and also like, I'm keeping this fun, I'm keeping it enjoyable, because you could hunt your ass off one season, be like, I'm never doing that again, versus like, I kept it fun, I kept learning, like I pushed myself, a lot of type two type fun. But that idea of like, not to the my breaking point. I've been doing a lot of solo stuff, so it's easy to kind of draw your own limit. But I also realized through hunting with people this year that it's easy to push your limit, because you know there's some guys there. There's somebody you could call. There's a guy on an in-reach, you know, half a mile away or whatever it is. So when did you pick up a bow for the first time?
You know, I've only been bow hunting now for probably, what, 4 or 5 years?
Hell yeah.
So,
dude, that's crazy. I don't want you to tell people where it's going. If you guys open his Instagram, you know where this is going. But that's nuts. That's crazy. Good shit.
Yeah, you know, I'm just that like type of person, though. Like, if I'm going to do something, I do it full tilt or not at all.
I'm with you there.
You know, I picked up a bow, and there's just something about shooting a bow that's fun.
Oh,
you know,
man.
I can go shoot a bow every single day, and I'll never get tired of it.
100%.
And I think that that's part of it.
We're in my living room, and you're staring down the barrel of my 6-yard archery range. 6-yard if I'm in the back corner.
Oh, that's awesome.
But yeah, I just like, I realized like, one, shooting is fun. And two, if you familiarize yourself with your bow on a daily basis versus a August basis or a month before the season, it's a different relationship. I told you out on the range, like my stuff got jacked a year and a half, 2 years ago or a year plus ago. And so I'm, one, hoping this one doesn't, but two, finally being like, okay, I chose this bow with a little bit of knowledge about hunting and archery, and I'm really excited to like lean into it, like broadhead tune by like March so I can go on a hunt in Hawaii or whatever, like really be dialed in way earlier this year, because like you said, that balancing act, I want to have more things like more stable earlier this year. So started 4-ish years ago. Did you just like, same thing. I made a lot of mistakes spearfishing. So with bow hunting, I just bought like a top of the line Hoyt the first time I did it. Did you kind of jump in the same way? It's just like model someone's build and kind of get good gear going into it? Or did you make a few mistakes buying the...
Oh yeah. I mean, there's always mistakes that you make.
Sure.
My first setup, I kind of just went off looks. I was like, oh, I kind of like that bow.
Mm-hmm.
And so picked that one. Luckily it was a, you know, good bow and capable of doing what I needed it to. But
sure.
I look back at that first elk that I killed with my bow and, you know, I'm a 27 and a half inch draw.
Mm-hmm.
And I was shooting these, you know, Easton 6mm arrows that were like 4 inches too long.
Uh-huh.
There's no way these things were tuned. And
right,
I just,
right.
So yeah, there's definitely a lot of mistakes that go into that, but that's all part of the learning process, and you just can't get it any other way. So
yeah. it's kind of a blessing in disguise to get my setup jacked, because I got like 75% of the insurance money, and then I got to be like, oh, I wasn't going to do this for another 3 or 4 or 5 years, and now I changed my arrow, I changed my broadhead, I changed my bow, and it was a lot of change for 1 year. I changed from a wrist release to a thumb button, and like, it's a lot, but also this is I've never felt more confident in a setup than I have with this one. And I think part of that is like how much I trained, but also like choosing the highest level components that I can afford that I thought were useful. I would love a carbon bow, but I can wear a glove on my hand, you know, like I can save myself a few hundred bucks by putting a fleece glove on. So like, there are some concessions I haven't made yet.
Well, this is the first year that I had a carbon bow.
Uh-huh.
I'll tell you, I'm not going back.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's so nice.
It is?
Yeah, not one, that cold riser and the weight too. Just like packing around that carbon bow is so nice when you're 6 miles into the backcountry. And,
sure.
You know, it's, yeah, well, not going back anytime soon.
Also, that's one thing I've realized, and it's so funny. Like, so I was just back in New York doing some whitetail hunting out of a tree stand, and most of my Western hunting is like pretty mobile. And like, I can carry a bow in my hand for like 6 or 7 hours a day, eat lunch, go carry it a few more hours. But in a tree stand, like, I'll hold it for like 15 minutes. I'm like, all right, put this thing back in the riser. Like, you just get so tired. I missed a deer this year because I didn't have my bow in my
hand.
I'm like, oh my God, you can do this out west. Like, focus, put the phone away.
That is a funny part of bow hunting. People always ask, like, what do you do with your bow while you're out there?
Yeah.
Like, it's like, well, I'm hunting, so the bow's in my hand.
I never
know when you're going to have that opportunity.
Dude.
And it's happened too many times where you're just not ready. And you just always have to have it in your hand. And
for real. I think I had an arrow knocked for like 4 hours during opening day, just because it's like, all right, like, I don't know what happens when I turn this corner, and I don't want to be mad that I don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
So it is a little dangerous. I heard Remy Warren talking about it, and he's like, don't poke yourself in the leg. Like, it's all on you. Be responsible.
Yeah, I've definitely seen a couple of those, and
oh God,
can be pretty sketchy. But yeah, that's another thing that I did this year, was I really upped the med kit and got a tourniquet and all that good stuff.
I did that too. I like bought sutures. I watched videos online on how to do stitching. I bought a tourniquet because I was just like, hey man, if I'm in the backcountry, I need to at least limp to someplace. Like, get somewhere you could get rescued.
Yeah. I've seen a number of buddies cut themselves with those.
Really?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Those knives with the replaceable blades are just so dang sharp.
God.
I had this, one of the guys I was with this year, he was cutting up a cow, and he got lucky. Like, he cut his wrist, but missed everything that was important, but it was deep. Like,
yeah, and like, I could see how you could get tired. You can just like get lazy with it. And besides butchering an animal, because of course, like, blood, you can't see anything, super sharp knife. I like read right before the season, like, most accidents in the backcountry are just when you're cooking your food. And this year I burned myself like 4 different times, like, fucked that up a bunch. And so I just realized, it's like, yeah, it's not, God forbid you like fall down an avalanche chute and break your leg. Like, it's going to be that you nick yourself and need stitches. Like, it's going
to
be something.
I thought that was going to happen to me for sure this year while I was cutting up my antelope.
Yeah.
I was not planning on being out there that long. And for whatever reason, I didn't have a headlamp in my backpack.
Oh no.
So I was cutting up as quick as I could right before dark,
like,
and
cell phone flashlight in your tooth or something.
I went with the cell phone in the hat method.
Good move. Good move.
You just can't move your head very much.
Yeah. Very stable. Well, I noticed that with guys who wear GoPro. Some of them do them when they're hunting on their head, but a lot of guys spear fishing. And you could tell how frantic people are by that footage.
Yeah.
And it's always so impressive to see a guy who's just like rock solid.
Yeah, I actually used to work for GoPro, so.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah. So, yeah, I've seen all the videos.
I want to document more things, but like we were talking before the podcast starts, I'm also kind of in this mode of like, do it first. Like, you don't have to show everybody what you're learning how to do. It is fun. Like, I like capturing. I like being able to scroll through photos and be like, oh yeah, climb that mountain. Oh yeah, snowboarded here, whatever it is. Just take pictures of the day. But I realized, same with spearfishing, it's like, Remy Warren talks about how difficult it is to like self-film while hunting. Even just to like take a picture of yourself and then go hunt, like, you're distracting yourself from what you're focused on doing. And so I don't know if you've played with that at all. Your photography is really nice, but I think we said it was just your iPhone, right?
Yeah, most of it's the iPhone. We also have, my wife and I have an A7 R3, so we use that for a lot of photos. And then I've got a little like Nikon DSLR that I take when we go bird hunting with my dog.
Oh yeah?
Yeah, I like to take a lot of photos of my dog. Just, it's so cool watching them work and seeing him retrieve birds and stuff like that.
Sure.
I've gotten some really cool photos over the years, and it only takes a second to whip out the camera and snap a couple photos.
Yeah. I'm into photography, but just on this side of like jumping in. I bought like these lenses for my cell phone so I can like get some wide angles, get some zoom, but like not necessarily need to do all the processing. And right before I moved to Colorado, I went to South America for a few months. And when I was on that trip, I was like, hey man, you are in a rush to nowhere. Like if there is a good photo, do not hesitate to take it. Like there's always an opportunity. And so I've kind of incorporated that into my life out here, especially on solo adventures. Like if something's beautiful, document it. Like there's no reason not to appreciate it.
I think that also comes with time in the field too, right? Like when you first start, you don't know what you're doing. You don't know where you're going and everything is kind of a little bit frantic, but the more and more I do it, I take it in a lot more. You know, you stop at a knob and you look out and you're like, man, this is beautiful. This is awesome. Whereas before, you know, you're just so focused on the task at hand that sometimes you miss some of that stuff.
Absolutely. And it's kind of, that can go for just the being out there and then also the pursuit. Like there's a lot of times I've found whether I'm trying to get to a tree stand or just get to a place that I think is interesting. It's like, hey man, you're hunting on the way there because you could just bump a bunch of animals, get there and then nothing happens because of your behavior. Or like be in the mindset always aware, hypervigilant, ready. And like always be ready has been my life this whole year. And I've been so screwed by it. It's like taking on all these new definitions because it's tough. Like hunting is a lot of mental, taxation, awareness of like what you're doing, how you're doing it and that hypervigilance of it. I'm curious how like, you've grown in that going from just like you buy a bow and then like picking it up, shooting to enough confidence, Rick, I can take this into the field to now where like you're going on some pretty serious hunts. You're putting in for some pretty serious hunts.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, it's a progression and it's doing the work and putting the time in. Like,
yeah,
to feel confident in your setup takes a lot and it takes a lot of shooting and it takes a lot of, you know, practice. And I mean, that goes for, you know, basically anything that you do in hunting, but the more you learn, I mean, I'd like to be a student of all aspects of hunting. Mm-hmm. You know, I'll take in information any way I can, whether that be people around me, you know, literature, videos, all that stuff. I think that that's all super helpful. And in today's day and age, there's no reason that you can't get out there, you know, as soon as possible. There's just so much information and knowledge out there. Not all of it good, but,
yeah,
you know, you kind of have to sift through some of it, but You can be confident and be able to go out there and, it just takes getting after it.
I like that you said that because I realize, it's really easy to consume and like consume to the point of like paralysis by analysis. And also it becomes like an interesting thing, right? There's guys who create like that content and people just tune into it because it's interesting. I might never make a knife in my life, but I've watched a million knives get made. And it's, I'm sure it's the same thing with Western hunting. And that's big because I do think you learn so much more by being in the arena than you do by watching somebody else, whether it's like feeling the wind on your face or your back or smelling an animal or seeing an animal. A funny like thought came to mind, and he may or may not listen to this. If you do, I love you. You know who you are. But a new friend, a friend of a friend, came on hunting with us this year, and it was like opening day, and my buddy was taking him up the ridgeline, and he's like faced away. He's facing my buddy like away from the hillside, away from the mountain, talking like full volume. And my friend's like, shut up. There's milk. And like my buddy took the elk and shut the guy up, but same thing was happening. The next night I'm up on that ridge with him and I was smelling an elk and he's like, hey Jake, what's going on? I was like, dude, still light out. Gotta fucking
whisper. We all have that one friend. I got a buddy like that went on his first rifle hunt last year and we're 300 yards from an elk. The elk's on private but working its way towards public. Mm-hmm. As soon as he sees the elk, I mean, he freaking loaded that thing like it was like he was in war.
Yeah,
they're right there, do you see them? It's like, yeah, shut up.
Hand signals. Yeah. And that's the one thing that's kind of made me proud of my growth out here is that like watching other people who aren't doing it to the level that even you and I are, which medium level, if you will.
Yeah.
It just makes you realize like, oh, I did come from like not this. I came from a place that none of this incorporated and I'm starting to pick it up. And like you said, like if you're into it, it's so easy to just jump in. There's so many avenues. If you don't want to fletch hours, you can go like read about something else. There's always something to be done. Have you gotten into much of the like building your own arrows and tuning your own bow and stuff like that?
Yeah, so as far as like building arrows, I really actually like to build the arrows.
Yeah.
I don't have a saw or anything like that, so I'll get them cut and then I'll do all the components and stuff like that and fletch them myself.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's something satisfying about doing that yourself and, you know, watching that arrow fly. As far as tuning my bow, I have a shop here locally do it.
Yeah.
They're the best in the business. So
same.
Yeah, there's only certain people I let touch my bow. I'm very particular about it.
And, yeah.
I think that's part of that confidence thing. Like if I did have the space and the resources to do it myself, I certainly would, because there's nothing better than knowing that it's done right by yourself. But if you don't have the means to do it, yeah, find a good shop and find someone that you know, is really good at working on bows, and you'll have that confidence and not have to mess with it.
I'm kind of with you there. And like arrow is something that's so particular. You go through so many of them. You can change your setup depending on the species you're hunting or your grain weights or whatever. There's a lot to be played with there with relatively low risk, right? Like worst case scenarios, you completely damage an arrow and it's $15 or $20 or something like that. But with a bow, like you can do one thing that has this downstream effect where it's like, oh, well, now I got to take it into the shop and spend $500. So I'm kind of with you there. The one thing that I'm a little in on this crossroads in is that I watch some bow tuning videos and I really like the way certain guys do stuff, but it's hard to go tell a bow tech you want something done a certain way because you have no idea what you're talking about. It's like, I just want that peep tied in a little better or whatever. And the guy's like, hey man, I work here, leave me alone. So I'm kind of with you there. One of the shops that I like a lot is No Limits, and those guys tune the hell out of a bow. So
yeah, Earl and Bo over there know what they're doing
for real. And that's one thing too, is like, I had a decent relationship with my bow tech back in Long Island. That shop ended up closing down, but I've developed a relationship with Bo, and it's just so nice. Like, hand him a bow, talk to him about what's going on. And he wants you to leave confident, right? Yeah. Like last time, I like had him do something that I thought was relatively complex. It took him like 2 seconds. I offered him some money. He's like, dude, it's fine. Like, you come here all the time. You spend a ton of cash here. Like, it's good. We want you to shoot right. And I'm like, man, it's nice to feel like there's a place where people have my back.
Yeah, it was awesome. Before my mountain goat hunt, I just wanted to make sure that everything was in line and took it to Bo. And he worked some magic, and I left there knowing that my bow is going to shoot exactly where, you know, I was aiming it. So,
yeah. Well, we could talk about tuning all day, but you kind of gave away the goose a little bit. I want to talk about your 2021 season, because our seasons have gone quite differently. For those listening, I didn't recover a turkey. I didn't recover a grouse. I didn't shoot an elk. I shot a white-tailed deer. It died on private, and now my season is over. So I'm like, not a bad streak of luck, but a bad year of recovering animals. I would say that the luck is really on me. Shot placement, choices I've made, but I think your season's gone a little bit different. I want to hear about it. So maybe we'll talk. If you want to give us like a quick synopsis of up until the big one in terms of like what happened, and then you can spend some time on that story.
Sure. Yeah. So I actually got married August 14th.
Hell yeah. Congratulations.
To my wonderful wife. And she, you know, is kind of the best thing that's happened to me and the reason that I get to go on this stuff. We've got two dogs at home and she holds down the fort while I'm gone. But
hell yeah.
The day after our wedding, we went on a little mini moon, and quickly after that, I made it up to Wyoming.
Wow.
Like a few days after our wedding. So that was pretty awesome. But we went up to Wyoming and I ended up shooting a buck there the first day that I was out. Yeah. I got permission up there and, you know, met some really awesome people. They took me around their property, showed me where these antelope were and stuff like that. And the landowner's son actually was super awesome and came out with me, and he got to go on these stalks with me. Nice. And I ended up shooting a buck out there, and he was also hooked. So as a little thank you, I sent him an old bow, and
he's that's awesome, man.
He's gonna get dialed in, and he wants to come out with me next year. So
that's great. Make and that man happen. His property, what an opportunity.
And then I drew a really good elk tag this year, burned a bunch of points on that, and it was something. Got into a lot of elk, chasing some really big bulls.
Yeah. Did you know they were there before you went in, or were you just kind of hoping?
I did a ton of scouting this summer. Like, I put cameras all over. I probably spent 10 plus days before, so I knew where the elk were going to be.
Using cell cams, or you going back and checking?
No,
cams?
I went back and checking. God, there's no service back
dude.
There,
that's
but
a
yeah,
ton of work.
Yeah, there's some of the spots that I went there. I'm like, I'm just gonna leave the camera. I'm not going back.
Yeah,
like I do not want to go back in
I'm
there.
Good.
But yeah, so ended up chasing one particular bull, this really big 340 class bull, and spent 5-6 days trying to get this bull, and ended up getting a shot at him. I was actually with another hunter that had a muzzleloader tag at the time.
Mm-hmm.
He got us access onto these little pieces above his property there.
Nice.
And he shot a cow out of this group that we had bumped, but we knew where they were going to go, so we cut them off. And right next to him, the muzzleloader goes off. Boom! There's smoke everywhere. And of course, the big bull's in the back, and I stop him and let that arrow fly at 40 yards. And, man, I thought I drilled him. Good blood right off the bat. You know, I'm shooting a 500-grain arrow with a good fixed-blade broadhead. And,
yeah.
You know, we never did recover that bull, which just sucks.
Dude, it sucks so much. Just I had my first big game non-recovery this year, and it's just like, God damn. Like, I'm out here to do the exact opposite of this.
Yeah.
The exact opposite.
Yeah, and we had five people. We grid searched for the whole day. I got a blood tracking dog. You know, I felt like I did everything that I could to try to recover that, you know, animal. And sometimes it just doesn't work out, and I guess that's part of bow hunting. If you bow hunt long enough, it's going to happen. It's just...
I used to not believe that.
Yeah. You know, that's the first animal that I've shot that I haven't recovered. So that was tough, especially on... a hunt like that where you burn those points and it's a good mature animal. And so after that over-the-counter archery season was going on here in Colorado, and I hunted a whole bunch of days during the week in between hunting elk, you know, from August 15th all the way through the very last day of the season when I ended up shooting that antelope. Yeah, I was on a stalk, dropped my rangefinder.
Midweek antelope or midweek elk?
Midweek antelope.
Man.
Yeah.
What a fun combo. And like, it's such a different mindset. I'm sure the stalking is good practice, but like, it's got to be such a different mindset. Where you're hunting, what you're doing.
Yeah. If you don't like crawling, don't archery antelope hunt.
It's not for you. Yeah. At least success is not in the cards.
It's a lot of crawling, a lot of frustrating stalks. I mean, you can see them all day. That's the fun part about antelope.
Yeah.
I think it's a really good hunt for people to get into as their first hunt, because you at least get to see game. You know, some of these elk hunts, right, you go out there, and if you don't really know what you're doing or you're not in the right place at the right time, they can be hard to find, especially on those
real hard to find
over the counter tags and stuff.
And it's
like
frustrating
that
when you're on foot not seeing stuff because you're putting in so much work. Like, I've been in a tree stand for a few years not seeing stuff until the buck I've killed. This year was the first time I was watching deer like all day, every day, and it made the whole hunt so much better.
Yeah.
So much better.
Yeah, definitely for a first hunt out west, I would recommend a rifle antelope hunt if you can get a tag.
Do it.
But yeah, so I ended up, I was on a stalk for another buck, and I was crawling through the sagebrush, and some point along the way, I dropped my rangefinder.
No.
Yeah, and it was a perfect stalk. I mean, I was under 70 yards, I guess 70. Right over his back.
Okay.
And that's when I was like, man, I want to go home. But there's some other antelope over here. It's the last day of the season. I got to go.
So with this guy who's on the table in front of me, did you have a rangefinder?
I did.
You found it?
I found it. Okay. Yeah. And it was funny, though, because I didn't have to use it. To where these antelope were, and there's this buck with a whole bunch of does. And he was all rutted up, making all sorts of noises and scrapes and stuff like that. But they were down in the swell, probably 150 yards. And I could not get any closer.
Yeah.
And I had one of those Ultimate Predator decoys. So I slapped that on the bow. I'm like, well, here it is. Hail Mary. Flash that decoy at him. I'm like, see if it works. And sure as shit, that thing came in
really
on a string. Like 10 seconds he closed that. He almost ran me over. Like 20 yards, he's like, oh, wait a second. I don't know what that is. And
that's
at this point,
wild.
I have my sight dialed super far. And I'm like, right? I'm like, oh, man. And so I bring it back in, and I'm like, he's got to be 60 yards, you know, set all that pin and let it rip, and heart punched him, and he went 20 yards and
Dude,
fell over.
That's sweet. We talked about this, using a single pin
spotter. Yeah. Yeah.
And I like what you said. You said, if you have time to range, you have time to adjust it. And like, I like that, because there's a level of intention there. I've also realized in those moments, whether it's focusing in on a fish or in that moment of execution on game, is like your brain is moving faster than time is moving. So you do have more time than you think you do.
Yeah. I think too, for me at least, you just make better shots. I know that like an elk's a big animal, right? And if mm-hmm. you've got five pins or whatever and you guess the distance a little bit wrong, you can be, you know, just a touch off. But for me, I like to be able to put that arrow right where I want it.
Sure.
You know? And yeah, it's worked out for me. I've taken a number of things with that single pin, including elk, and I've never had an issue with it.
Hell yeah. I love that. So closed the deal on the antelope, packed it out in the nighttime with your cell phone light.
Yeah. Yep.
That's great, man. I haven't had it. How are antelope eat?
Oh, they're probably an unpopular opinion, but they're probably my favorite.
Really?
Yeah.
Is it like a dark red meat, just like
no,
deer elk?
No, they taste like antelope. I don't know how else to explain it. You know, they're different, but they're really good.
Yeah.
And I've had a lot of friends over this year where I've smoked, you know, different types, deer, elk,
yeah.
antelope, that type of stuff. And everyone says that the antelope's their favorite too, which
really?
Has surprised me. But
hell yeah. Definitely, you inspired me to put in for it next year. I was like, you know what? I can start my season 2 weeks earlier at the very least in my Colorado season. And so I'm definitely going to do it. And seeing this thing in front of me, like, all right.
Yeah, I'll never shoot an antelope like this again, probably.
Dude, this thing is so big. I'll put a picture of it up.
Yeah.
It's so sweet. I'll see if we can get it on the CBA website too.
Yeah, we green scored them right around 81-ish. So
it's big boy.
It'll be close. But yeah, pretty awesome for a over-the-counter archery tag.
And so you got two antelope this year, Wyoming and then Colorado, and then you went on your elk hunt. Tell me about this one that, if you guys first put your Instagram handle out there and everybody go check this picture out.
It's, Vondi. It's VONDIII.
Triple I.
Yep.
All right. Now tell me how you shot this freaking mountain goat, dude. This is so crazy. Also, if you guys notice, he said 4 years ago in Colorado, you have to put in for 3 years before you're allowed to go mountain goat hunting. So, I want to know your interest in mountain goats, when you decided to start putting in for them, and like what happened when you like found out you actually got it. Because for me, I was like, the hunts that I'm not ready for, I just ask for a preference point because I don't want to get caught off guard. I would hate to like get a moose opportunity, be like, all right, I got to quit my job and figure this out.
Yeah. So, I mean, I've been a resident of Colorado for longer than that, but when they changed the preference point system for mm-hmm. the moose, goat, sheep to where you just had to basically pay for the preference point versus
yeah.
you know buy the tag and get
oh you've
the
been
amount.
Applying back when you just
yeah,
had
so,
to get a unit
and so yeah
so for people listening, if you're in the CBA, you probably know how this works. If you're not in the CBA, join it. And if you're interested in Colorado, you have to be a resident to obviously draw your in-state resident tag, but you can put in for a draw unit. And if you don't get that unit, you get a preference point, or you could now, which is Ryan's saying wasn't always the case, directly put in and just get a preference point, not actually give yourself an opportunity to get the tag.
Yeah. So the preference point price, I mean, and this was too, like coming out of college, mm-hmm. you know, so paying 200 or 300 and whatever before that just for a preference point was tough.
Wait a minute, they used to be, because it's like $50 now.
Yeah, no, you had to
buy the tag
basically. Yeah.
Oh man, that
yeah,
is
and
rough.
Then it changed to, which was probably unpopular for those guys that, you know, could afford paying that every
sure
year.
Sure.
So then it went to the system that is now where it's $50 for a preference point for each of those
sweet
each year. So
I got that timing right. We'll see if I ever actually draw it. Point creep might
yeah
might screw me, but
well, that was the thing. So I drew that tag with 3 points,
man. You told me that you're like 3-0. I was like, what's the 0 point?
Yeah,
like, I drew it on
yeah
my third
so no
year.
No weighted points, which means I probably burned all my luck for sheep and moose, so I'll probably be 80 years old if I ever draw one
yeah
of those
but
tags.
What is it you have to nothing for what, 7 years? Is that Colorado or is that
so for this mountain goat tag,
yeah
now there's a 5 year waiting period.
5 year.
And then you have 3 years before you can even be in the running again to get a tag.
But there's like a legit possibility that you get one before the age of 60.
I would say, possibly.
But most guys don't get that, which
yeah.
is pretty cool. So good on you. So, you put in for 3 years in a row. Now, were you specific about this unit for a long time, or was it just this year where you're like, I got to figure out a place to hunt mountain goats?
No. So, I spent a couple long days in the pit with John, who's my cousin.
Yeah.
And, if you know this guy, John Legnard. He is a sheep fanatic.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. And he literally writes the odds for every single one of those hunt codes in the brochure.
Oh, okay. So he knows it.
Yeah, we could be sitting there and I'd be like, S69. He's like, oh, here's the odds for this, yada, yeah. yada. And so we went through based off of all the points and all that, and he works his magic, and I somehow got lucky enough, and I drew that tag. So it was a fourth rifle tag.
Nice.
And it was a nanny tag.
I didn't know that mountain goats have more than one season.
Yeah, so for this particular unit, there's four seasons. I think there's a total of 20 tags for that unit across all four seasons.
Gotcha. And you can use a rifle or a bow.
Yep.
Cool.
Yeah. And the choice was pretty clear right when I drew it, I want to do with my bow.
That's ballsy, man. I mean, like, to get such an opportunity and to say, like, I'm going to make it much harder.
Yeah.
It's crazy. But you also said that you had some good guys with you, too.
I did, yeah. So Jeff Meese, who is a past he's a vice president for RMBS right now. And
which
then,
is?
Rocky Mountain Bighorn Society.
Awesome.
Yeah, and this guy's killed everything under the sun. So, and then Zach, he is a buddy of mine who got into it. He was with me for my first archery elk kill. And
nice, man. Oh, he must have been so stoked.
Oh, I mean, I put in all this work, you know, 15 days prior to that. I take him out there on a Friday night, and we park the truck, walk out. I let one bugle rip. 30 minutes later, an elk's down.
Wow.
That's what he thinks elk hunting is, right?
That's so cool. That's cool that he gets to come on this one, because this is way different. You got to get up there. What elevation were you when you took
So I ended up shooting that nanny around 13,000 feet.
Damn.
Yeah.
Almost as high as you can get.
Yeah. I mean, I was... If I don't ever have to walk through any of those scree fields again, I'll be happy.
Dude, it must be so nerve-wracking. I was going to ask you at the end, but I'm curious on that hunt. Like, were there any moments where you're like, I'm just not going to go over there? Like, I see animals, but I'm not going that way. Or, like, how do you brace? Because, like, I'm a little scared of climbing. I do some indoor climbing. I don't do some outdoor climbing. But I've been watching some guys who just mountaineer like it's their job. Like, they just – crampons and ice axes are so used to it. And I'm like, huh, to get to that level where like the mountaineering part's secondary, that's kind of like where you have to get to with archery to a degree. Did you have much high country, experience before that, mule deer or skiing or anything like that?
Oh yeah. So I do a lot of touring.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've done a couple of those, you know, longer trips in the backcountry. I've done the Grand Traverse, which is a ski mountaineering race from Crested Butte to Aspen.
Oh, I've heard about that. I was actually, Crested Butte to Aspen. Yeah, I was biking Crested Butte behind Maroon Bells this year, and my buddy was telling me about it, and I was like putting it all together in my head. I was like, that's wild. You did that.
Yeah.
So was it 13 miles?
40 miles.
40 miles. Maybe 13 miles as the crow flies.
Yeah.
That's crazy. Oh my God.
So yeah, I've had a, you know, a little bit of experience like that, done some 14ers, and but this is totally different. Like, most of that stuff, as far as like the hiking goes, everything's on a trail, right?
Yeah.
You never are going up the side of a mountain that's just scree,
uh-huh.
you know? And it, I hadn't really been up in there before. Like, I'd done a lot of scouting for the goats
sure.
prior, and, but I'd never actually like step foot where they live.
Yeah.
And you gain a whole new respect as soon as you start doing that. I mean,
man,
you can, when I, luckily for my hunt, there wasn't a lot of snow. At least on the southern exposures, it was pretty burnt off still. So, getting up to some of those spots, you know, you needed micro spikes and stuff like that. But
yeah.
there's no, luckily they weren't on any of those northern exposures.
Yeah.
So that made it a little bit better. But as soon as you start going up there, it's like you can easily see them, right? They're a white animal on a brown hillside. So they're not hard to find. But as soon as you start going up after them, you can't see anything.
Right. Cause you just have
it's
such
straight
steep,
up. Yeah.
yeah. So you, that's one thing I learned my first year with, elk is like that little pin you drop where you think you, the animal is needs to be accurate, not
yep.
vague. And so, I know some guys will take pictures zoomed in and then save it. Like, what, do you have any specific strategies for like stalking an animal when you when it goes out of sight in terms of what you like to do, how you like to lock that in?
Yeah, I do like to drop a pin as best as I can.
Yeah.
And then after that, it's just going really slow and methodical and always scanning. I like to have my binoculars out and take a couple steps, scan. Take a couple steps, scan.
Yeah.
That way you're not missing anything. But yeah, this is like, but there's no being quiet when you're mountain goat hunting.
No. And I know that they're used to some noise in terms of rocks and stuff falling. One thing I've done, and not that I'm the most successful hunter in the world, is when I'm sitting there like making up a game plan, I'll record myself making the game plan saying that you're going to go here, there, there, and there. Go to this, you know, aspen stand and then hike down 100 yards. And I do that because you get in the moment, you get so excited, you're like, what was my plan? What was my plan? So, like, to rewatch that, if I remember to watch it, helps me, like, slow down for a minute.
Yeah.
Reapproach. We're a little all over the place, I guess. Walk me through,
I can walk you through the hunt. Yeah. So, got up there for the day before opening day, and I went into this basin. I was kind of targeting a specific nanny, a real good, old, mature nanny, pretty distinguishable. And located her. I've been watching her kind of all summer. And so we go up there opening morning with my buddy Zach. Mm-hmm. And he was supposed to be flagger.
Yeah.
He forgot his binoculars.
That's useful in cheap country.
So it's tough to flag somebody when you can't even see them.
Yeah.
So anyways, to make a long story short, it was kind of a debacle. There's goats all over the hill, and I could get close to them, but I could never find this one that I was after. And
goats aren't super spooky, from what I hear.
Yeah, no, they're not. They're generally curious by nature, but for whatever reason, the only goat that spooked that morning was that nanny that I was after. And she took her two kids, and they bailed off, and they went over into the snowy stuff, and never to be seen again. Oh, I mean, no. You just can't. I don't feel comfortable enough to be, you know, making a sense in that snowy conditions. And so
wise of you, that's how you hunt the next year.
Yeah. So we looked over some more of those goats, but it's also the first day. Right. And, I didn't want it to end that quickly. Mm-hmm. So we went and checked another basin. Luckily that's when the backup arrived. Jeff
checked
came in.
Another basin, like got in your truck.
So we completely hiked out of there, and then moved a couple drainages over, and immediately found goats, but they're all the way up at the top.
It's a ballsy call to make too. Never leave animal to find animals. I mean, like, I get it,
but yeah. Well, this particular unit, there's a lot of goats in there, and pretty much if you want to put the time in, I'm sure you could find, you know, a couple in each basin. Mm-hmm. But there's so we relocated and immediately saw these goats, but they were just so high up there again.
Yeah.
And after, you know, making one summit already that day up to 13,000 feet and that shale stuff, like, I was beat.
And where are you start? 9,000, 8,500 feet?
No, you're probably still like at, in between 11 and 12.
Okay. That's nice.
Yeah.
Cause like I've very rarely done like a 3,000-4,000 foot day, and it's miserable. Man.
Yeah.
It's terrible.
Yeah. So, but like I said, you gotta go.
You gotta go.
And there wasn't a way to really judge these ones because they're so far away.
Sure.
Even with a spotter, it was windy. And, so I ended up, you know, trudging up the hill and, got close to a couple goats. I was at full draw on one that was like 30 yards, but I couldn't get their attention down below because when you shoot these things,
you need someone to watch it.
Yeah. To see where it goes.
Yeah.
And, so I elected to pass just because I didn't know if they were able to see what was going on.
So are you kind of, as you're stalking and glassing back to your spotters?
Yeah. And then we also had walkie-talkies, but they were not working.
Yeah.
Essentially. I was basically at that point just by myself. And so I passed on that one, and they're also super hard to judge. Like, the difference between a good goat and, you know, not a good goat is half an inch.
Well, you said, which rifle were you in? Three? Which
fourth.
Season? You were in the fourth. So their fur is super thick.
Yeah,
at that
super
point
thick.
Too,
yep.
Which a lot of guys like desire. Some guys in other states will hunt like they'll not kill the animal so they can come back when the fur isn't thick. But I could imagine that because it puffs up, the differential between the sizes becomes harder and harder to tell.
Definitely. And that's kind of the allure of the later season for me was getting that good hair.
Yeah.
Especially with a nanny tag. I mean, most people aren't going to be able to even tell the difference between a billy and a nanny.
Yeah.
Like, when you're out there, it's tough. Unless you spend time looking these things over and really getting used to it, they can be tough to judge. So, yeah. So I elected to pass on that goat, and they kind of moved off. They were a lot more weary than I thought that they were going to be.
Yeah.
Like, everyone's like, oh, you can just walk right up to him. And that really wasn't the case. Yeah. Especially I think after in that particular area, after a couple of rifle seasons, like they were like, what the heck is this guy doing over here?
I also can feel like predator behavior is different than observant behavior. You know, I've noticed it with fishing is that like, if you do not act like a predator, like fish will be cool. But if like you are hunting them, making eye contact with them, like they are spooky. And it's the same thing with animals. They have an instinct about them.
Yeah. And I tried my best to fit in as a 14er hiker, you know,
solids.
And all that good stuff. But somebody carrying a bow and a pack is just not necessarily normal. But yeah, so as these ones were moving off and I was getting ready to call it because it was getting pretty late in the day and I had to make it down that stuff.
Right.
Going down in the dark is probably not advised.
Of course.
And at the last minute, you know, this nanny popped out below me that I saw and she didn't see me.
Yeah.
And I was like, that looks like a pretty good nanny.
Yeah.
And so I was like, I'm going to give it a go. And I dropped my pack and I guess you call it stalking, but sliding down the scree field.
Yeah.
And it's amazing. Yeah. They do not seem to care about that. And
so weird.
So she was like right behind a bluff and so it was 20 yards and I was like, man, I don't know if I'm going to get another opportunity like this. Like I'm going to take this opportunity, even though it's late in the day.
Yeah. Yeah.
I felt very confident in the shot. To me, it seemed like a good nanny.
Were you standing on one knee? What was like, how did you have to take that shot?
Yeah. So I was on my knees to start with.
Yeah.
I went to full draw and then actually got to stand up. And because it was so steep, like I had to lean into the shot too. And so yeah, 20 yards at that super steep angle was, you know, it's weird. Like you don't take those shots very often.
No.
It's a lot different than
tack practice. Once a year. Yeah.
Practicing in the backyard. And so I made the most of that shot. And luckily Zach and Jeff down at the bottom had the spotter on it.
Nice.
And saw it. And so, yeah, she took a little bit of a tumble. But not too bad.
He
got hung up down at the bottom of this avalanche chute. And yeah, from then it was awesome. I mean, even though it was only a day, like it was truly a once in a lifetime experience. And I know people kind of throw that around, but I may never get to do it again.
Sure.
And I felt like I got the most for my money. Like it was
absolutely, man.
Even for one day, it was a lot of activity.
Wait, this was the same day
you
relocated? Wow.
Yeah, so I ended up shooting her at like 5. So that means we had to pack her out in the dark.
That's
cut her
wild.
Up in the dark on the side of this this, you know, basically cliff.
Yeah.
So it took them a while to get up there and we snapped some photos and
beautiful photos.
Yeah.
You got a beautiful lake, sunset.
Yeah.
You guys have to check this out. Say the Instagram again, Vondi.
Vondi,
three eyes.
Yep.
VONDIII.
Yeah, and you can't even make it any better than that.
No.
It was just like so cool. Yeah, so they made it up there and we got her packed out and oh man. What can go wrong will go wrong, you know.
Yeah.
Headlamps were dying, just steep. Couple tumbles and stuff like that, but
oh no,
you just got to take it slow on that stuff.
Sure. And at that point the job is done. You're not rushing to get to a spot, you're not rushing to get to bed.
Yeah. And luckily they're not huge. It's not like packing out elk quarters.
Yeah.
You know,
you
so
two guys, you probably each packing like 70 pounds.
Yeah, so there's
pounds.
Three of us. I mean, there's only like 50 pounds, maybe a little bit more of, you know, quartered meat and then the full cape.
Yeah. And then your gear.
Yeah. And the gear. So yeah. And luckily, you get to go up light because the truck's right at the bottom.
Nice.
Yeah,
that's
so you don't
great.
Have to pack anything in.
But I guess you got to have water, or did you find some seeps up?
Like? No, yeah, I had water and all that stuff. And, yeah, having a good pack definitely makes that a whole lot easier.
What are you rocking?
Kefaru.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You like it?
Oh, yeah.
I've been thinking of making a change. I've been rocking, I have like the whole Kuyu Icon Pro series, and I have three different sizes, and I like it, I don't love it. And then I was looking to make a change and I was like, God, I forgot how expensive backpacks
yeah.
are.
I had that same pack and I could just never get it to work right for me.
Yeah.
And then I switched to the Kefaru and yeah, I'm not going back anytime
yeah.
soon.
Yeah. See, man, maybe we could talk about this afterwards.
Yeah.
But
yeah, so we got down to the truck and by the time we got down there it was 9:30.
Yeah.
And I'm super glad that that I ended up shooting her that day because the next day a storm rolled in.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh man.
And it wasn't in the forecast and, yeah, it dumped a couple inches of snow up there. So
man.
It made it tough. I know some of the other,
tough.
Yeah. I know some of the other tag holders that season, and they didn't end up tagging out. I just didn't come together for them. So
good for you, man. Yeah, it's one thing to be hunting elk for me at like 9,000 feet in the rain, but to be hunting at 13,000 feet in a snowstorm is just no fun. Yeah. I don't know who has fun in that.
Yeah, not me. That's for sure.
That's amazing, man. So you got it out. You told me you're going to do a full mount, huh?
I am, yeah.
Oh, I'm so excited to see that.
I don't know where it's going to go. My house isn't overly large.
Sell it to Cabela's, maybe. Yeah.
No, that's going to be going somewhere for sure. We might have to get rid of a TV or some paintings, but
it's better to look at than a flat screen.
Yeah, it might be the centerpiece in the living room.
Dude, that's cool. Yeah, just on the dining room table. Screw it.
Yeah, no
that's
way. Awesome. My wife is going to let me do that, but one can dream.
That's amazing. And that was 2020, or was this year?
That was this year.
When's the fourth rifle season?
That was in October.
Oh man, so I met you like a week after. Yep. You did that. No. Yeah. Wonder you were so psyched. Oh dude, that is awesome. Well, one, I appreciate you sharing that story, and two, like, not being shy about it. You know, of course, like, guys are gonna be like, oh, what the heck, he's been doing this for 4 years. We all put in, we all get lucky, their odds, that's what it is. But yeah, like, to get it done, and also to hunt the way you do, like, I think it has a lot to do with your mindset and probably a lot to do with who's in your circle. But you seem to be very intentional. You're finding specific animals, you're going after them. Even if you're not going after them, you're going after a certain class of animal. And like, I'm not shaming anybody. I shot like a 100-pound doe last week and I was super psyched to recover it, which I didn't. But just that idea of like, hunting is fun, and hunt for the reasons you hunt. But it also seems like you're very specific with why, what your why is. And I'm curious as to like, we'll wrap up here in a couple minutes, but like, your goals with hunting, because you've achieved a lot early and quickly. And so like, what do you have in mind in terms of keeping it fun, keeping it interesting, challenging yourselves? How do you want to like grow in this?
Yeah. I mean, there's still a number of things that I haven't done. Like, yeah. I've never hunted whitetails, for instance.
Uh-huh.
So I have an Eastern Plains tag this year.
Right.
And, I think some of that, trying new things, I haven't ever hunted bears.
Yeah.
You know, I've got a mountain lion hunt this year.
Nice.
That should be pretty fun. But yeah, I think just a lot of what drives me is to be able to say that I've accomplished this stuff. So like, one day, right, I'd like to shoot the Colorado 8 with my bow.
Yep, I'm in the same boat, man. I met a lot of those guys. I'm like, God, you guys are cool.
Yeah. So I've got a ways to go, but I think that having goals like that is definitely kind of what motivates me and pushes me to keep going.
Yeah, and that's much more reasonable goal than the Colorado 10, because no one will ever draw a desert sheep,
yeah,
tag in their life.
Yeah.
But yeah, I like that. I like that a lot. And I think not only like having goals, but to piggyback a little bit, is for me, like, one, my kind of current focus is like archery elk. And there's some peripheral goals in there and some other hunts that I do, but that's my goal. And like, I really came close to getting it done this year, and I would have, like, I know I would have felt a different level of confidence if I got it done and brought it home. But at the same time, I felt myself at the end of this season being like, you can make a decision where like, you keep going down this path and it's going to have a lot of failure in it, or you like pivot. And I'm like, well, nothing worth doing is going to get easier, right? Like there's one thing about scary. There's one thing about like longevity. I don't necessarily need to learn how to start base jumping. I'm sure, yeah, that's tons of fun. But at the same time, just that idea of like, I'm going to stay after it. I'm going to set some goals. And I think the big 8, maybe not in the next 10 years, but in the next 20, like, is doable.
Yeah.
And maybe in the next 5, who knows? Next season, you could do half of it, right? That's the thing that's, yep, crazy. I had an elk, a deer, and a bear tag this year. I chose not to get an antelope tag. Like, you can do a lot of it pretty quickly. My not next, but one other thing is like moose. I am so intrigued by moose.
Yeah.
I had some really good moose encounters this year, and I'm like, man, it's got to be on the list.
Yeah, and some of the stuff too that we were talking about before this as well, like, I'm pretty big into doing some of the fitness stuff.
Yeah.
And that definitely drives a lot of what I do too.
Like, does it tie in at all? In
of terms course, of, yeah. Like, I feel way more at ease, or, you know, it's easier in the mountains after you have done all of this stuff, you know, the training for other goals and races and things like that definitely translate.
Yeah. I've found that I've for now been able to get away with like snowboarding super hard gets me ready for hiking, and then hiking super hard gets me ready for hunting. But I've now realized, like, I want to not be like, okay, day one and two, I can solo archery elk hunt, get an elk out of the woods. I want to be like, all right, day 30, I killed an elk and I can still get it out of the woods by myself.
Yeah. So I do like a lot of specific training just for that, like rucking.
Yeah.
Find me on Green Mountain a lot of days leading up to the season. But I'm also big into, you know, marathons, Ironman, stuff like that. So I kind of keep that fitness year round, and it may not be hiking, but it definitely helps.
Do you find the endurance? Cause like, that's probably where I'm weakest. Like, I'm strong and my walking endurance is there, but like, I can't run more than like 2 or 3 miles before I start like huffing and puffing.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Especially, and I think a lot of it too, like you said, is mental.
Mm-hmm.
Like, just doing that stuff makes it easier.
For real?
Knowing that you can, you know, run a marathon or do an ultra marathon or whatever, right? Like, then walking through the woods isn't that hard.
It's so interesting how, like, thinking the anticipation of something is super scary. Doing it the first time isn't super scary, but it's scary and informative. And then the second time, it's like nothing. Like, I've been hunting in the same unit for a little while, and the first year I like didn't go that far past the trailhead. And this year I realized like how far deep people actually go. And I was like, oh, it makes so much more sense now. Like, I was like, got 6 miles in, and then some dude was driving his like Chevy down. They paid $1,200 for trespassing fees. But I was like, I think I'm the asshole, not this guy. but that's great, man. Dude, I really appreciate you spending some time with us, telling your story. I'll definitely put some photos up, link to your information. Is there anything else that you want to send people towards, or any, you know, besides your Instagram or anything else you're doing out there? Is any?
Nope, pretty simple guy.
Beautiful. Well, I really appreciate it, man. And I think as long as we're both in the state hunting, we'll just like check in every now and then and see how you're doing and see how the season and life is progressing, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Hell yeah. Awesome.